This is the fifth day of this January 2010 Rohatsu Session. And today we'll finish up with the chronological biography of Zen Master Hakuin. This is from a book called Hakuin's Precious Mirror Cave, edited and translated by Norman Waddell. We left off yesterday with Hakuin at the age of 62 reassuring someone about hell. A samurai, he was saying, how could a samurai fear emptiness? Go down into the evil paths right now. Take a good close look at all the different hells you see while you're there. And when the samurai asks him, is it proper for a Buddhist teacher to tell a student to enter the realm of hell? Hakuin laughed and said, I've been there myself many times, seen all 84,000 hells. I haven't missed a single one. Then we're told that there was a serious famine that year, obliging the monks living in and around Shōinji, Hakuin's temple, to disperse. We can hardly imagine these conditions that they practiced under. We've read about the terrible lack of food at Hakuin's temple, and this was still worse, causing them all to disperse. Hakuin, at Bodhidharma's death day, Hakuin wrote a verse, winds sweep by like angry seas, blasting field and garden, scattering my idle spirits and wild demons far and wide. 20 worthy men, monks with vitals sheathed in iron, chew on vegetable stalks, keenly savoring the adversity. He delivered a commentary on certain text, and after the meeting, a monk came from the assembly seeking the master's instruction. During the interview, he said, I've kicked Lin Chi's 3 barriers over on their back. I've gone 7 steps beyond Xuanzha. And then Hakuin said, those aren't your words. Where did you get them? And the man said, I found them in a discourse National Master Hongko delivered when he was installed as temple abbot. And then without thinking, Hakuin prostrated himself, then lifted his arms up in reverence. It's like talking about salted plums and finding your mouth watering, or like knowing the taste of a certain food by sampling a morsel from the cooking pot. It's a pity you're unable to see everything that's in that pot. When he was 64, at the end of the spring training session, the monks training there asked that the master lecture on the Zen records of Daito Kokushi. He's a great Japanese master before Hakuin. He was a national teacher. That's what Kokushi means. So there was one Zen teacher selected to be the national teacher. May have involved some politics, but he was one of the most esteemed in Japanese history. Hakuin refused and said, 30 years ago, when I was in Mino province, I accepted at face value some groundless remarks I heard someone make about the record of Daito, and because of that, I was led completely astray. That's one of the things I skipped. It was just something belittling Daito's teaching, or recorded teaching. Later on, a single word or phrase from the record was enough to set my teeth chattering and my knees quaking. I would like to oblige you, if only to stop you from pestering me, but the sea is so vast, the waves so high, I'd have trouble even making out the shore. It would be foolish to attempt such a task. Well, we can't know how much of this was genuine feeling of inadequacy as in the task of commenting on the great Daito Kokshi's teaching, and how much was the just the self-effacing style of the Japanese. But it's interesting here, after all that, then it goes on, encouraged by the master's response, the bunch of senior monks got a hold of a printed edition of the record of Daito. They worked together, came up with a plan for the master's lectures, and when they took this work to him and begged him to reconsider, he was no longer able to refuse them. There's this whole there's this whole dual layer of communication in Japan that, without having lived there for many years, one would not be able to understand. And this seems to be one example of it, where everything he says would be, forget about it, you know, this isn't going to happen. But they're encouraged, and sure enough, they prevailed. Roshi Kaplow often spoke of how difficult it is in Japan to navigate all of the subtle social cues and communication ellipses that that go on there. Not to mention the fact of the etiquette of never knowing when you might be violating some facet of Japanese etiquette. He said it's like walking on eggshells all the time. Winter. Tore returned to Shōinji to resume his training, and and Hakuin presented him with a certificate of transmission and his gold brocade Dharma robe. I learned in a closer reading of this morning that Tore was not his, he was a Dharma heir of Hakuin, and it would seem from reading this his favorite disciple, but he was not his successor. A Dharma successor means taking over the temple. Tore didn't take over Hakuin's temple. Another guy did, who we're going to run into very soon. In fact, right now, he had, as like a lot of these teachers, he had three or four different names he was referred to. So I'm just going to pick one and stick with it. Eboku. There was just one mention of him earlier. Yeah, just when Hakuin, this was just, let's see, 65... So this was just 3 or 4 years earlier. It just says, in a very flat reporting style, it says, Eboku of Shimotsuke came to study. The first time he laid eyes on Eboku, the master knew that he was no ordinary student. That's all we have until now. A few pages later, age 65, says, Eboku returned from Kumano to resume his training at Shōinji. the master's face flushed with anger as he reproached Eboku. The noise around here bothered you so, you ran off into the mountains and spent your time with the rocks and trees. You said you needed peace and quiet. Where did it get you? He gave a loud shout. So there's some backstory there that we can only wonder about. Maybe he felt that that Eboku had sort of left him high and dry there. He could have been a real help to him. But who knows? But Eboku became his Dharma successor at Shōinji. One day, Hakuin told the assembly of monks, "The Buddha Dharma is like climbing a mountain. The farther you go, the higher you get. The important thing is not to retreat, not just remain where you are. From the time I entered Shōju's chambers," that Shōju was his main teacher, "and began to receive his instruction, my mind was always disturbed and uneasy. Waking or sleeping, I couldn't shake that feeling. This winter, I have reached my 66th year. Now, I often feel as if I'm strolling through the Dharma groves with Master Yunmen," another illustrious Zen master, Chinese, Umon, Yunmen. And then it just says, "His words made a deep impression on all those present." Apparently, Hakuin had this blend. I mean, his reporting that even after his two enlightenment experiences, that his mind was always disturbed and uneasy. Suggests that, you know, he's unusually sensitive, emotionally sensitive, but with that, this tremendous strength of spirit. It's just awe-inspiring. Skipping through some years here. There was a more recent or maybe current national teacher, not Daito Kokshi, who was earlier, but a more recent one by the name of Gudo. And Hakuin sent letters to senior priests in Gudo's teaching line, urging them to arrange for an edition of Master Gudo's Zen records to be published. Discussions were held and various opinions were voiced, but in the end, they were unable to reach any decision on the matter. Now, here's the reason I'm reading this at all. Their lack of enthusiasm incensed the master. So he didn't always get his way. And then there was a ruined temple that was to be rebuilt by the name of Rutakuji. This is where Roshi Kaplo first went in Japan and spent a few months with Nakagawa Roshi before going on to Hoshinji and Harada Roshi. That they had plans made to rebuild Ryutakuji, and the decision was made that Tore, the Hakuin's biographer, who's supposedly writing all this, Tore was appointed as abbot there, and Hakuin let him go. Now he's 74. He opened a lecture meeting on the Blue Cliff record and addressed the monks assembled there. Whatever I hold up to elucidate for you, be it only a shard or a pebble, is transformed into a piece of pure gold. Where I am now, even when I'm sitting and joking and chatting informally with people, I am turning the great Dharma wheel. Look! Look! We can say that in the widest sense, in the absolute sense, everything we say and do is the Dharma. That's understanding Dharma as reality, truth. The narrower meaning of Dharma is the law or the teaching of Zen or Buddhism. Now he's 78. And Torrey tells us, from spring onward, a general debility brought on by old age and illness was increasingly evident. The master had lost his former vitality and alertness. Lecturing left him extremely tired, as though the immense energy he had been pouring into his teaching activity was now used up. By midwinter, the decline was even more pronounced. But then he reported, he got up one morning and reported that he had a most remarkable dream and that it had completely restored his spirits. I now feel just the way I used to. It's a rather long dream. Sitting with a number of senior priests and one of them said, it's just these two words that we lack. All of those present, even the senior priest sitting across from us, were eager to know the two words. And then he told them, bravery and valor. And then the whole room broke into applause. And then Hakuin says, as I was reflecting on this, it suddenly dawned on me that the people I was with were all deceased. This is still his dream. I declared loudly, how can I agree to remain with you here? And that's when I woke up. Then he gave another big meeting, lecturing on the record of Daiyo Kokushi, not Daito, but another national teacher, Japanese national teacher, Daiyo Kokushi. But as it progressed, he became extremely tired, got Torrey to share teaching duties. And then he formally retired as abbot of Shōinji, turning the position over to Eboku. Here's just another little nugget that will leave us in the dark, but I read it because it brings a little more of the full range of human human character into what otherwise is largely a hagiography. It says when he was 80 that he and Ebuku, his Dharma successor, had a falling out. So Ebuku left Shoenji and went to stay at another temple. The master's compassionate old heart was much troubled by this turn of events. Efforts by the senior priest to console him helped ease the pain. Then they had some more quarreling when there was a contingent of monks who wanted him to go to Edo, which was the name of what is now Tokyo, the capital. And they loaded him up on a palanquin and tried to get him started on the journey to the capital, but other monks blocked the palanquin from leaving. He had to return. This happened a second time. The monks who blocked his departure said, "Our teacher is old and weak from his long illness. You and these others come and try to carry him off to Edo. It is sure to make his condition worse. As his students, how can we stand by and let you or anyone else take him away?" And then some other senior monk said, "The master's infirmity is only temporary. Besides, he himself has expressed a growing desire to go." Well, anyway, he convinced the monks to let the party proceed and go on to Edo. And then another time, there was a proposal to have Hakuin conduct the winter practice session at Ryutakuji. It just says disagreements came to the fore, leading to heated arguments. During the spring and summer months, the master spent time relaxing and enjoying the waters at Kona Hot Springs on the Izu Peninsula. And now we're coming to the end. This is age 83. At the end of the winter training session, the master took once again to his sick bed. The physician who examined him said, "You are too addicted to sugar." I can't imagine someone doing that. "Your illness is caused by the harmful effect of all the sweets you eat. We'll have to purge the sugar from your system." He gave the master a purgative, and after several visits to the privy, the master seemed to feel better. The physician sequestered him in a room and forbade him to have visitors. And then with the aid of uninterrupted sleep, he was able to regain his strength. And then later in the year, toward the end of the year, the area was swept by a freak storm that sent lightning bolts crashing violently to earth. The next day, the physician, Furugori, came and examined the master's pulses. "What do you think?" asked the master. "Nothing out of the ordinary," he replied. "Can someone be called a skilled physician when he can't even tell that his patient has only 3 more days to live?" Futagawri sat with his head bowed. A certain lay disciple was allowed to visit a Go board, you know, the game Go. A Go board was brought out, but after two or three moves, the master was forced to stop. Finally, he called Eboku to his sick bed and entrusted him with his personal affairs after his death. At daybreak on the 11th, the master was sleeping very peacefully, lying on his right side. He made a single loud groan, and passed away. And then there's an epilogue by Tore referring to this final utterance, this was in every way comparable to the great death cry of old Zen master Yun Tao. Remember, this was the great previous master, Chinese master, who was run through by bandits and let out a cry. Ordinary people, upon hearing that the master did not compose a death verse, might mistakenly think, Master Hakuin lost a fine opportunity to make a final Zen utterance. And then this Tore says, wrong, wrong. That was perfectly appropriate. It penetrated straight through the heavens above. It pierced through the yellow springs below. I believe that it was superior by 10 times to the final instructions and death verses Zen monks usually leave behind them. Ah, when he declared that he was the kind of man who appears only once in 500 years, it certainly was no exaggeration. And then I want to read another of the appendices by Tore about a woman disciple, Satsu. We hear so little about the enlightened women in our tradition. And this is a very interesting piece. She was the daughter of one of Hakuin's cousins. When she reached the age of 15, she thought to herself, I'm certainly not much to look at, but fortunately I have no physical defects. I don't think it'll be long now before I find a suitable husband and am married. She prayed to Kanon for help. Mornings and evenings she chanted the Kanon Sutra and was reciting it constantly, even when she was sewing, washing, or cleaning. After a few days, she suddenly experienced a realization. And then it says, according to the account of the story given above in the chronological biography, Satsu was squatting on top of some volumes of the Lotus Sutra in her bedroom. Her father reproached her, to which she said, what difference is there between the Lotus Sutra and my derriere? Her father, not knowing what to make of this, went to Hakuin. Hakuin assured him that he could help her. He wrote out a waka poem. If you can hear the voice of a crow that doesn't caw in the darkness of night, you'll welcome the father before you were born. And told the father to hang the inscription up on the wall somewhere in his house where Satsu would be sure to notice it. When Satsu saw it, she said, Hakuin's handwriting. I'd expect something a bit better from him. When this was reported to Hakuin, he told Satsu's father to bring her to the temple. Getting called to the woodshed. Hakuin asked some questions. She responded easily with no hesitation. He gave her some koans. She pondered them and a few days later penetrated their meaning. Hakuin then tried to assign her some additional koans, but she said she was no longer interested, and when she stood firm in the face of Hakuin's entreaties, he struck her with his bamboo stick. Similar encounters took place in the following weeks and months, but 6 months later, Satsu had passed all the additional koan barriers the master had given her. One time, Satsu's father decided to find her a husband, but she was not interested just then. Her father enlisted Hakuin's help. He summoned Satsu and said, "You have penetrated the Buddha's Dharma. Why are you so opposed to the world's Dharma? You should follow your father's wishes." Satsu bowed her head in agreement and was married soon after. Later in life, Satsu's granddaughter died, and she was suffering extreme grief over the loss. An old man who lived next door came over and admonished her for weeping and wailing. "People in the neighboring village are talking about you," he said. "They say she practiced under Master Hakuin. She achieved Kensho and Satori. This grief over the loss of your granddaughter is excessive. Don't you think you should reflect over your actions?" Satsu glared at the man. "You confounded old codger," she said, reviling him. "What do you know? My tears and sorrow are far better than offering her incense and flowers or lighting candles for her. You don't know anything, you old crock." The man left without another word. This reminds me of what Tore was just saying about Hakuin's final utterance, that the number one thing in Zen practice is to be fully authentic. To have the integrity to express oneself. When you're grieving, then you grieve fully, thoroughly, without self-consciousness about what's the norm, what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. And then in grieving that way, you're more likely to move right through it, get it behind you. Then the Tore reports that outburst was more or less characteristic of Satsu's severe and biting comments. The monks who resided at Shōinji and took their questions to her, thinking she was just an old woman, invariably came away looking very miserable indeed. When Satsu passed away, Hakuin's disciple, Eboku, remarked to the assembly, "During the old master's lifetime, many people were able to attain a clear and unmistakable enlightenment. Of them all, Satsu stood preeminent. Even veteran monks, men who had practiced many years, could not approach her." That's the end of the biographical account of Hakuin. And now, before we close, I'd like to go to another book of Hakuin's teachings. And present his own teaching, his own direct words. This is from a book called The Zen Master Hakuin, translated by Philip Yampolsky, and it's also a collection of several sources, several texts. And I'm just plucking a paragraph out of the middle of one of them, a chapter called Ora Te Gama 1, just as a sampling of Hakuin's writing and his spirit. "How truly sad! Man is endowed with the wisdom and form of the Buddha. There is nothing that he lacks. Each person is possessed with this treasured jewel that is the Buddha nature, and for all eternity it radiates a great, pure luminescence. But while dwelling in that true land of the pure Dharma nature of Vairochana Buddha, where this very world is the light of Nirvana, people, because their eye of wisdom has been blinded, mistake this realm for the ordinary evil world, and err in thinking that it is peopled by sentient beings. Sentient beings meaning unenlightened people. That's the mistake they make, thinking that these are all unenlightened beings. In this one birth as a human being, one so difficult to obtain, they spend their time wandering about like ignorant horses and oxen. With no discrimination whatsoever, they extinguish the light and wander through the realms of the three painful evil existences and suffer the sadness of the six forms of rebirth, six realms of unenlightened existence. They grasp at the true land of Vairochana Buddha's unchanging eternal calm, and in their fear and delusion cry in pain, believing it to be eternal hell. They pride themselves in their ordinary, pointless, insignificant views, reveling in the small, prejudiced learning that has entered into their mouths and ears. They do not believe in Buddhism, have not listened to the true law, end their days prating nonsense, and have failed to guard even for a moment the mind that is master of true meditation. More pitiful still is that they revolve for eternal kalpas in the coils of their evil actions. And even more frightening, they earn only the bitter fruit of the long nights of birth and death. Here's another passage, even more close to home, where he's teaching on the koan mu, how to work on mu. When a person faces the great doubt, before him there is in all directions only a vast and empty land without birth and without death, like a huge plain of ice extending 10,000 miles. He's describing a deep samadhi state, but not yet awakening. As though seated within a vase of lapis lazuli, surrounded by absolute purity, without his senses he sits and forgets to stand, stands and forgets to sit. Within his heart there is not the slightest thought or emotion, only the single word mu. It is just as though he were standing in complete emptiness. At this time, no fears arise, no thoughts creep in, and when he advances single-mindedly without retrogression, suddenly it will be as though a sheet of ice were broken or a jade tower had fallen. He will experience a great joy, one that never in 40 years has he seen or heard. At this time, birth, death, and nirvana will be like yesterday's dream, like the bubbles in the seas of the 3,000 worlds, like the enlightened status of all the wise men and sages. This is known as the time of the great penetration of wondrous awakening, the state where the ka is shouted. It cannot be handed down, it cannot be explained. It is just like knowing for yourself by drinking it whether the water is hot or cold. The 10 directions melt before the eyes. The 3 periods are penetrated in an instant of thought. What joy is there in the realms of people and heaven that can compare with this? This power can be obtained in the space of 3 to 5 days if the student will advance determinedly. You may ask how one can make this great doubt appear. Doubt, of course, meaning questioning. Do not favor a quiet place. Do not shun a busy place, but always set in the area below the navel, Jiao Zhou's Mu. Then asking what principle this Mu contains, if you discard all emotions, concepts, and thoughts, and investigate single-mindedly, there is no one before whom the great doubt will not appear. When you call forth this great doubt before you in its pure and uninvolved form, you may undergo an unpleasant and strange reaction. However, you must accept the fact that the realization of so felicitous a thing as the great matter, the trampling of the multi-tiered gate of birth and death that has come down through endless kalpas, the penetration of the inner understanding of the basic enlightenment of all the Tathagatas of the 10 directions, must involve a certain amount of suffering. When you come to think about it, those who have investigated the Mu Koan, brought before themselves the great doubt, experienced the great death, and attained the great joy are countless in number. I'll let that speak for itself. We'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.